is cheesy. The plot is stupid.
I'm sorry, the plot is bad.
That's a little opening.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to a sort of educational edition of ARG Presents. I'm your good buddy, your good pal, and a man who looks nothing like Plato, Amigo Aaron, joined by a man that, you're getting there. I give you the Brent.
I think we could both pass as a small tube of Plato.
Maybe. If you saw us from behind, you might be able to pull that off. Please do not consume. This week, I was talking before the show to everybody. I'm very excited. We spun the wheel. We made the deal. The confusing deal. We didn't know what we were doing.
No clue.
And this show was hard to put together. We had to get help. But at the end of the day, I found it very enjoyable. As we're going to take a look at something I really didn't know enough about. In fact, I knew practically nothing about it, which is the Plato system. It's the Plato system of computers, which is really not true. It's basically a educational setup. We'll get into it. Did you know anything about? Well, I want to before I get into it properly. Listen, we need to learn it, Plato. Hold on a second now. Remember Kinder and Gentler. Did you ever know anything about the Plato at all?
It's not. It came out before I was
You've never heard. That doesn't mean anything.
No.
I thought maybe you'd heard. I mean, I'd heard. The reason I knew we talked about Plato at one point, and we did, is during our Telengard episode. We covered Telengard, and Plato came up. In fact, the game I chose came up in that episode. So I did have an inkling as to what the Plato is. This is a large, sort of complex category, so I'm going to try to sum it up as best I can. So I'm going to have just enough rope to hang myself with, but I'm going to try to sum this up. So let's flash back to the 1950s, United States.
Okay.
Someone thought it would be a good idea at the University of Illinois to come up with a way to use computers to help in education. Okay. A very simple philosophy. So they got together and they tried to come up with a method to pull this off. They couldn't come up with one. Seriously.
Yeah, I know.
And so they pretty much gave up, and they were drafting a letter to say, yeah, we can't figure this out. And before they sent the letter, the guy drafted the letter was like, wait a minute, I know one guy that may have an idea of what to do. And he contacted the fellow, and the rest is history, because they actually got this thing off the ground. To start off with Plato, Plato is a very famous philosopher, a Greek philosopher who was born in 427 BC. I told you I was going to mention it. You can give the guy credit. They named it after him. And so he's considered one of the world's great thinkers. And so it's apropos that you would name your massive educational computer system after him, except, even though they didn't.
Except Plato stands for something.
Well, so there's a funny story behind the name. Plato stands for Programmed Logic for Automatic Teaching Operations.
Yes.
And I saw this in several places where they mentioned that they had the military involved in this, because this had, the university had been working on classified military operations. And they were switching over to non-classified work. And so they thought that if they named this, they gave this a cool military-style name, they could get over, like, for fundraising purposes. I mean, it worked. So I'm going to give them credit on that.
I don't know about worked.
What do you mean? It worked great. So, again, this was up at the University of Illinois. They eventually came up with Plato 1, which came out around 1960. So what is, when I say the Plato 1, this isn't the thing you see on your desk.
No.
This is in fact, the original Plato, if you look at it, there's a huge, the university had one of these huge, like, ENIAC-style computers, the big room-filled ones,
yes.
Right?
And by room, we mean cafeteria.
I mean, it's a huge room.
Yeah.
And then you would have a person that could program on this thing, and you program using a line printer, right? And it would kick out the program to these. It's a kind of sort of a combination of a monitor and a microfilm center, and they had this rigged up to where you could interact with a keyboard, and you could get lessons from it. And it was actually not too shabby early on. They did a good job starting out, and they got excited about what they had. And so the Plato, as they refined it, it grew pretty quickly. And by the early 1970s, you had worked into the Play-Doh 4. And you had also, what you had done with the Play-Doh is, instead of having the original Play-Doh would have a terminal hooked up to that large system.
Yes.
Eventually, the Play-Doh 2 had two terminals, right? And then the 3, you could have 100 terminals. And eventually, you would have, they had like around 12 Play-Doh setups around the nation. Some were military, and some were commercial, and some were university servers. And they had thousands of people using these things. It's your simple, dumb terminal gimmick, except when they got to the Play-Doh 4, it was quite remarkable because they had that amber screen that you know so well.
Yep.
And a keyboard, but it was a touch screen, and they could actually had graphical implementations on the screen. So by the time this came around, you were actually getting into something here. You had all sorts of kiosks where people could sit down and use these things. And originally, I went back and watched some of the old documentary footage on this, and it's actually quite fascinating because they're predicting in the 60s and 70s, they're like, yeah, this is going to be great for teachers because one teacher could take on tons more students and they can be remote. They could stay at home for their education. They could work in these remote centers for education. So primarily, this thing, in fact, almost 100% was there for teaching lessons and stuff. And it was considered very successful. Eventually, in the late 70s and early 80s, they ended up making it so you could actually hook up your little home microcomputers to the system. So you had your Apple could do it, the Atari computer could do it, the Tandy could do it. They could hook up a cartridge or whatever, and they could actually get on. You could actually do it today. Like with the Atari, that's how Boat got on. He uses Atari, so you can do it. You can do it today. The system is still around to wait. I'll get to that.
Now, I have discovered a slightly alternate history than the one that you just described.
All right, go ahead. Yeah, because I got to hear this.
From what I heard, and this was some of the people. This was an interview that was done 14, 15 years ago with some of the people that actually set up the original Play-Doh system.
All right.
And they said the primary reason, I mean, yes, they were setting it up to do educational stuff.
Yeah.
But the primary reason they went with terminals is that they were sick of taking their cards or their tapes. Because back in the day, you didn't just own the system, right? You took your tapes or your punch cards or whatever, and you brought them to a guy and you handed them to him. And you rented out a certain amount of time on the system,
yeah,
like a half an hour for small programs, an hour for large programs. But you couldn't put them in. Someone else had to put them in. So you went, you took your cards or your tapes and you gave them to the guy, and the guy would feed them into the machine,
yeah,
and get the output, whatever the output was. And you'd come back a half an hour later and they would hand you your cards back and they would hand you your output. And if you made a typo or had one figure off or whatever, that, sorry, you lost your half hour. There was no chance to fix it. You have to reschedule time and come back. And that is why they decided to make this a terminal-based thing, a line command terminal-based thing. Another thing I saw, or heard, I should say, was the whole reason that the Play-Doh had any graphics at all, because it was going to be a completely text-based thing, was someone working on the project was into bridges, right? And being able to show a bridge at, you know, 20 miles away and have it scale and then you have it what it would look at from 10 miles away. And that was his whole purpose on adding the line art and that kind of capabilities to the Play-Doh, was because he wanted to be able to visualize these things that he couldn't do otherwise. So I guess those aren't necessarily contradictory to what you were saying, but maybe in addition to.
I didn't hear about either one of those.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't be surprised, because originally graphics were not, I mean, obviously, in fact, there was, in the early days, this was, like I said, it was based on like sort of a microfilm.
Yeah.
It was very, I will say, looking at this, what it reminded me of, it's like reminded me of playing like Astron's Belt or something, because it was video or imagery with computer generated text over it. It was. I was really surprised for that early in the project that you could do something like that.
Yes.
I mean, I guess what I'm saying is you can sit down and learn stuff for real.
Yeah.
It knew stuff. One of the things I like in one of the videos I saw, there was a key called the AHA key, right? And that key would be when you were going through and using this educational stuff, after you'd done a bunch of work to try to figure out the answer to these questions, when you got it, you could hit the aha button, and it would take you back to where the original question was, and you could type in the answer. Pretty clever, I thought. So, with all that said, flash forward to into the 1970s, 1972, you get the Play-Doh 4. The terminal switch thing cost 12 Gs.
Yeah.
I saw a figure from a guy at a conference. He said 2 bits of memory in, like, 1950, it cost so much money that, like, to have, like, a MacBook from, say, 10 years ago, it would have cost $34 billion. So that shows you what you're dealing with here. So, of course, what happens when you've got a national, like, network of computers? Well, what happens is the unexpected, in this case, although now we would expect it, people started writing things to interact. And really, if you, this is the crazy thing about the Play-Doh that I didn't know. This is really the birth of like social media. I mean, the ability to have messages from long distances. This is where message boards were made.
Yes.
And the predecessor to Lotus Notes that was lifted, that was directly from the Play-Doh system. You had basically electronic mail was from here. You had multiplayer games. Live, simultaneous, MMO-style multiplayer games were developed for the Play-Doh system. And we'll get into the first couple of those today. So you had a lot of stuff going. Never get a lot of action on these little amber things. So the funny thing is, after a while, the university sort of like, they basically sold the Play-Doh system to a commercial outfit that took it over and held it for like a long time. People, I was stunned to realize that this entire network didn't cease operation until 2006.
Yeah.
It was around until 2006. Crazy. And
that's some staying power. So
some hobbyists were like, we're not, and it, by the way, the licensing is still around. And it's funny, the people pointed out that they always were making money of this. So in 2004, the final version of Play-Doh, they had, again, the company was out until 2006, but they took the network down a little bit before that. The last surviving version of the Play-Doh network was resurrected. And this is where we come into what we did this week. So this, you can access this network via a multitude of ways, including like modern 8-bits can still get on. I mean, not modern, but you know, like the, from the 80s, yeah. Ataris. You can also get on here with your browser, and there are a couple of methods, but you have to sign up. And you have to ask for access, for free access. And so I didn't know this. You didn't know it. Pajaco, thank God for him, he went on and said, listen, you got to sign up for this. So I signed up right away. I just got access yesterday, but I still use Pajaco's ID on there because my access was acting goofy. So we could thank Pajaco big time because if it wasn't for him, we'd have been boned on this one. It's funny to look back at this now. It's very exciting, actually, to me, because if you think about where this project started in the 50s, where you had a one lone terminal hooked up to a big super machine. That was progress just for the input points of it, the fact that someone could use this that was didn't know what they were doing. Because if you look at these machines, it's just like watching old 50s or 40s or 60s sci-fi show. I mean, it's real crazy. It's crazy. There's lights. You know, this gives you a nice compact terminal. And I think that in the span of like 10 to 12, 14 years, they went from one single terminal, you know, and a programmer that uses a line printer to enter data all the way up to where you had thousands and tens of thousands of users all over the world that were using these terminals. It's quite impressive for the amount of time it took. And it got me to thinking about modern computing and education. Of course, when we had the unpleasantness a couple years ago, and everyone had to, like the Luke had to work at home off of his PC. And I can tell you, it was an unmitigated disaster. Not because for Luke, just because people weren't familiar with that. They didn't understand how it worked. They didn't pay attention. Their computers weren't up to spec, whatever. And I thought to myself, this is ultimately what happens when you go away from the model that Play-Doh put out, which were dumb. Everyone had a dumb terminal, the exact same type, not at their house, but at a learning center. when you've got different computers and different internet connections, stuff all over the place, it's going to be a lot more difficult to implement the kind of thought direction that they were going into when they originated the Play-Doh. And it makes me wonder if maybe we could get something like a more modern version of that in schools. Maybe there is to do, because it's not the worst idea. My kids hooked up to computers at school that do some educational stuff, but it's not like every school has the same set of computers and the same, because I mean, if you did it universally, you could issue the same commands, the same lesson plans. You have the same teachers record programs for everybody to learn this stuff. Do you have a thought on on modern education with the computer systems?
I mean,
come on, get into it. That's what this show is all about.
Yeah, but I don't. I think we've passed that. I think the
ship has sailed on that.
Well, the cost, first of all, to implement something like that would be astronomical. Then you've got the maintenance, because
it's for the children,
the world we live in, you can't have technology. You can't have kids learning on technology that's 10 years old. So you're going to have to continuously refresh it. It would just be a financial nightmare. I'm not saying it wouldn't be beneficial. I'm not saying that there isn't merit. There isn't good success behind what you're saying. But the cost to implement would be prohibitive.
You know, just to close out this, one thing I thought was amusing is, like, I was watching a guy talk about this in like the 60s. He was talking to a teacher. And he goes, yeah, because we're going to have these terminals all over the place to teach the kids. And the teacher was looking like, huh? And he goes, listen, we're not talking about getting rid of the teachers. We're talking about just you can educate more kids at once. And you'll have more spare time to work on your lesson plans. And you could tell the teacher wasn't buying it. She's like, nah, you're going to fire me. It's what they thought. And I think that's also been a hamperment to the whole system, because teachers, and rightfully so, they're like, wait a minute, if they automize all this, I'm screwed, you know? Although it's funny, because here in West Virginia, we've got an incredible lack of teachers. Like, we can't get anybody to teach nothing. They're all leaving, you know? So someday we may have to hook the Pluto back up and go back in there and give her a shot. You never know. We get to do it. I'm sure we probably have some of those sitting around. Wouldn't surprise me. So please, if you're interested at all in what we've been talking about, go and check it out. There's some interesting stuff online about the Play-Doh, including there's a very awesome graphical, like a demo that a guy made, and it's like 72-1-1. There's all sorts of people talking about the history of it. I mean, we passed, it hit the 50-year mark about 10, 12 years ago. So yeah. I mean, this thing's 60 years old. If you think about how far we've come in 60 years, you know, it's quite remarkable, just technology-wise. But in terms of the Play-Doh, it's funny that it's still available, and I can understand how people could still use it and still get something out of it, having used it this week.
Well, I mean, get something out of it.
Hey, listen, math plans and stuff never get old. They're evergreen. You can always throw them.
What do you mean from an educational standpoint? Yeah, for elementary math and stuff like that. Absolutely.
Yeah.
One other thing I want to state. Before we move into the games proper, in the thing I was watching, they had talked about when they had first got this to a terminal point, right, where people are writing code at the terminal on the machine, punch cards, tapes, they were out of the picture. They said that they would pay college kids $1 or $2 an hour to go in there and actually do the work
that I've heard
for these computers.
I mean, type in the code.
On these million-plus-dollar machines, and you're thinking $1 million back, you know, 60 years ago, you're talking $100 million things now.
Yeah.
And they were completely unsupervised. They would come in late at night after all the classes and stuff were done. They had their own key, and that is how a lot of this other stuff got produced.
Yeah.
Because they would go in, they would do their work on what they were going to do, and they were learning how to program during all this time, and they were like, man, I wonder if I can make a little thing, I don't know, like a little horse betting. And they would start doing it.
Yeah.
So it's crazy to think that some of the reason why we are in gaming where we are today is because they were paying these college kids nothing to go in there and plunk on the machines, and it was they earned trust enough that they were able to do their own things on them.
I'm glad you brought that up, because you're right. That it's the birth of a lot of this crazy stuff. And you never know where you're going to be. Everything's built in the building blocks of the people that they came before them. And a bunch of cheesy teenagers laid the foundation for sort of what we're into now.
Yep.
And speaking of which, one of the things we got to do, when you log into the Pluto Network, I keep saying Pluto, Plato Network, you have access to a million different lessons. But what we were there for was to do a little gaming.
Yeah.
Because Plato gaming,
We did look at some of the educational stuff too.
And so we had a list. I believe there's about 128 games on this list we looked at. And so
128 lessons. When you log them up,
they are listed as lessons. And so we actually, before we get into our games proper, we did tour around a little bit and try out some different stuff. Were there any games that struck you as particularly interesting or enticing, aside from what we picked, obviously?
I unfortunately got a lot less time with this than you did, just because of how things fell and we didn't get the access until as late as we did. But I remember, educational-wise, I looked at a program called Bees.
Yeah.
And Bees, this would be for your kindergarten or before type thing. And it was the whole program was you could either put bees into the hive or you could take bees out of the hive. And let's say you had 10 bees, right? And 10 bees, they're all in the hive. And then you take out 3 bees. And it's all visually represented on the screen with line art.
Yeah.
It's quite, which is quite good.
It looks good.
And the game would ask you, okay, there are 3 bees outside. How many bees are still in the hive? So, you know, for a little kid to have the visual representation of, I see the 3 bees that are outside. I can't see how many bees are inside the hive, but I know I started with 10 bees. It's a visual component to math at that very young age.
Yeah.
Instead of just being told, 10 minus 3 is 7, to have that visual representation, I think is huge.
Well, I mean, huge. These are the evergreens for this I'm talking about. It did look pretty good.
Yeah.
The funny thing about the Play-Doh system is you're going to be surprised how well a lot of it looked.
Yes.
I was quite surprised. And of course, it goes back to the real. I mean, you're talking an amber monochrome monitor, yeah. But what you get with that is the real precise, sharp graphics and lines. It's good at those.
Another thing I looked at was horse racing. Now, yeah. This was not educational. This was a betting simulator, but it had a little bit of charm with it. You're at the track, you put in your bets, and the jockeys will take off and they're riding down the thing. Some of them will topple over. It's amazing how far visually.
It's for their riders. Yeah.
Yeah. It's amazing how far visually these things went, considering what they had to work with. I mean, it was exactly what it was. It's a betting simulator that you just play around with. But I thought it was interesting that they had the things where they threw the jockeys off. They had a little winning celebration. And not animation, but still. And it was fun. It was a fun little way of doing it.
Yeah. One of the games, in fact, I almost picked this game, but circumstances led me not to pick it, was they had a multitude of sports games on there. And they had a game specifically called baseball. And what they had done, they had simulated every season up to 2020, I believe it was. And you could hop in and just play one of the games that was available. And I think you could only play one a day, because I played one game, there was no other game. And then there were a few games I tried, like football or basketball, where there were no games available at all. So some of the games just straight up I couldn't play.
Well, out of season.
Right. Well, no, it's not that.
I bet it is. I
mean, basketball's in season right now. Anyway, so baseball, I picked a couple teams that were available. It was a very nice setup with on-screen graphics that showed the diamond, just like you'd expect. The guys running around, it would show. You wouldn't necessarily see the play, but it would like if there was a guy that hit a fly to right field, the right fielder would kind of blink, and he would get the ball. And you can type in what you wanted to do. Do you want to bunt? Do you want to do you want to swing away? What am I doing? It was a limited interactivity, but it was real nice. And I simulated a full game of this because I was sure I was going to pick this one. And like I said, then I couldn't get back in.
Yeah, and which meant I couldn't play it at all.
Yeah, and so Brick didn't play it a bit. So that one got ixnay, but it's we'll probably put the playthrough up because I didn't see a full game anywhere on the internet on YouTube. We also tried
for baseball. Did it allow you to pick pitches? Did it go that deep, or was it just mostly simulating and batting?
It was mostly simulating batting. To be honest with you, I played about an inning. And then I was like, okay, I'm going to simulate this game, watch how it works, and then come back. And I never could play it again. So I sort of got screwed on that. I tried a game called Asteroids. It looked like Asteroids. It played like Asteroids. It was vectory. It played just like you would expect. I mean, was it the smoothest Asteroid experience I ever had? No, but it played fine.
Yeah.
It had shields, the whole nine yards. So there was Hangman, and there was Checkers. The stuff you would expect to find in on a system like this was available, plus a multitude of text-based games and that sort of thing. Did anything else stand out to you aside from those handful? We tried to play fishing. We couldn't. Me and Brent, it's funny, we picked the same games to play, not even knowing. And Fishing War was what I wanted to try, but I couldn't get it to work either. So some of these just straight up aren't working anymore. The one thing I found interesting about a lot of these games, though, was that, for example, baseball, you can play two players at the same time that were on different computers somewhere.
Yeah.
It's simultaneous where you can play the computer. A lot of the games had built-in interactivity. In fact, a good chunk of the games, if you didn't have another player, you couldn't play.
Yeah.
You had to have someone else on the system at the time. So there was a lot I missed out on. If we were to go back and try this again, we got our accesses in, it would be kind of neat to go back and try some of those multi-person
the two-player
games
stuff, yeah,
to see how they went. But I think we stumbled upon a couple worthy games this week. You want to go first?
Yeah, I'm going to lead the show off here. And I went with golf, straight up golf.
Yeah.
Now this was made in the 70s. I couldn't find an exact date. I don't know if an exact date is necessarily known, but this was written by Lane Friedman and Michael Grobman, and it earns the title of just being able to call itself golf because this was the first golf. This is
the first one.
Yeah. A very interesting take. First, I want to talk about the aesthetics and how the game works. You can play any hole, right? But to join the golf club, which is it is presented as a prestigious thing. And then there's the whole, this game oozes this kind of passion, this kind of, you need to be part of the part of the clique to really matter, to get your name up on leaderboards.
It's just like a real golf club.
Exactly. And there are multiple golf clubs. But to get that status, the first thing you have to do is play 18 holes of golf. And even as you first drop in, you're allowed to just pick a hole here or a hole there or just play the front nine or whatever. But to get, you know, the prestige, you've got to play a full 18 rounds of golf or 18 holes of golf. And then that will allow you to join the club and get your name up in the rankings. It also sets your handicap because the way this is played is even though you are playing alone, you can play with others. You can have tournaments and have the leaderboards and stuff like that. And the game tries to adjust. It can't adjust the difficulty because it can't change the course, but it gives you that handicap so everyone can kind of play together. Before you even get to that screen, though, you have to choose if you want instructions or not. And you want instructions.
Yeah.
Because it's not overly complicated. But it's not something you can just fake your way through.
No.
So you load up the instructions, and it tells you, it says, okay, listen, this is the course. You know, it shows you what a hole is going to look like. It shows you what line patterns says this is the fairway, what line patterns. And what I mean by that is you'll have a geometric shape, a square, a circle, whatever. If it has lines that are going vertically through it, that means it's one thing. If it that means water. If it has lines going through it horizontally, that means sand trap. If it has it going diagonally, it means out of bounds. And it has to present itself that way, right? Because of the type of...
It's monochrome.
Right, and it's, you know, this. It's just using graph commands to draw the golf course anyway, but it does it very quickly.
Yeah.
You don't have to set...
It's not like world-class leaderboard where you set there and wait. It's not quite the graphical fidelity either. But.
Well, of course. But that's what I was afraid of. I was afraid it was just going to sit there and draw all the time.
Yeah, the Play-Doh's surprisingly snappy. Everything it does.
So, and I'm sure some of that is juiced up from its modern hardware that's running on it. But it's impossible to know for sure. So you have, it says, you know, it explains this is the tee box, the green, blah, blah, blah. And then it says, okay, this is what you're going to do. You're going to choose a club. And it tells you how to choose a club. You want to choose one and then put a W for wood or a number and then an I for iron. You've got S for sand wedge, P for pitching wedge. Those are your clubs. And then it says you can put how much power you want to hit this club with. The reason why that's important, I found out, is even if you are, let's say you are under a tree, right? And normally in golf, you would want to punch that out. And it doesn't really have punch commands. But what you can do is have a nine iron or a one iron, less power, and try to shoot it out toward a sort of affair.
Because you will go in the woods.
Yes. So it lets you put in how much power you want to use. And then it says, what angle do you want to hit it at? And this is where I'm assuming most people are going to get stuck.
I had trouble.
Because it is based off of a circle. So that means it will allow you to hit in 360 degrees. If you want to hit the ball backwards, you can hit the ball backwards. The 0 point for this circle is directly to the right.
Show him your system. When Brent played, here's what he would do. He'd be like, set an angle. And he'd put his arm out like this and go,
yeah. Well, you have. Well, I didn't do it all the way around.
That's exactly what he did.
I mostly did it with my hands.
It was great. Well, it worked though.
It did. Because you have it doesn't have it visual on the screen. I 100% guarantee people who played this big time were super into it. Had protractors and were sticking it up on the screen.
Yeah, well, this is the legion of super dorks.
They probably had one with them. So, zero's directly to the right, which means if you want to go up the screen, you've got 90. If you want to go left, it's 180. If you want to go down the screen, it's 270. And you have to estimate your angles off of that.
Really, that's the game right
that
there.
That is the game. Yeah. And then when you get close enough to the green, it has one overview of the hole. That is the view you get. And it does have a little animation of you hitting the ball. And the ball doesn't fly up in the air or anything like that. No. It just has the ball moving from where you were to the point it ended up.
It's a dot.
It does travel.
I had trouble finding that dot sometimes. I put it somewhere real bad.
And once you get close to the hole, I think it said within like 30 yards.
Yeah.
It will take you to a different view, and that is kind of like the green view, where it shows a close-up of the green and the hazards around it. That was really, really cool, because you could have putted from that overview, but it would have sucked.
We've seen tons of games where you putted from the overview.
Yes.
This is better.
And so it zooms you in and allows you to adjust even if you're not on the green, if you're just close, it allows you to chip out of hazards and everything like that. This game really blew me away, and I didn't want to stop playing it.
He did, because he told me, he's like, I'm going to come over for a cup of coffee. And he played this game for like 40 minutes. Yeah, this is good.
And it's the one more hole. Even though I was getting, it was making up numbers, like quintuple-loopity bogey.
I heard something I've never heard from you in my whole life.
What's that?
He goes, yes, double bogey.
Yeah.
I was like, wow. But when he started off the first hole and hit like rolled 20 over par, double bogey is pretty good.
I never got that bad, but it was a learning experience, but it was fun. It was a fun learning experience. I learned, you know, because when I first started out, I didn't understand where the angles were. So that first hole was really rough.
Yeah.
Hunting, you have to adjust your strength, and that is challenging until you start getting a doubt in. But I felt myself getting better, and my score showed that.
Yeah.
The holes are interesting. They're not just straight shots, but they're also not super death, unbelievable holes either.
Yeah.
They, you know, you've got a fairway that's lined with trees. You've got wind that does affect your shot.
Yeah.
And it blows in different directions and at different miles per hour.
Plus, if you're in the sand, you've got to get out of there.
Yeah.
It's not, you know,
the hazards actually mean something. If you're in trees, you can't hit full power shots because they're just going to go straight up into the branches.
Yeah.
When you're in the sand, all of your club strengths are reduced, obviously. If you go in the water out of bounds, the ball is placed hand like it would on an actual golf course. Everything visually represented, as long as you read the instructions, I think made sense, right? And there was a few of things I would get confused on, but for the most part, I understood what everything was supposed to be.
Yeah.
It has a nice visual low banner that says what golf course you're on, what hole you're on, the par, how many yards you've got to go. It's all nicely put out there, just like a modern golf game would have.
You know, the golf game, and I want to mention this about the baseball game too. You can tell dorks, like ultra geeks, made these games, because like in the baseball game, for example, you could just put the score, right? This has the score, the name of the stadium, the date, and the attendance is written down, and the temperature, and the golf game is sort of like that too. It's superfluous, extra information you don't need, but it's still there.
And here's the thing you have to remember, Aaron, there were no golf games to copy this off of.
Yeah.
This was, you know, there was probably board game golf games. In fact, I know there are that play kind of like this. So I could be wrong, but I bet that's where they pulled this type of feel from. But I had a great time with it. I had a great time. What did you think of golf overall?
Well, I'm going to start off by saying this. In case, and by now you should probably know this, but if you haven't heard it, I'm going to spell it out. The Play-Doh can play games, real games, like fun games. This isn't one of those things where you sort of like, be like, well, I'll struggle through. It's kind of fun. No, it'll actually play a fun game.
Yeah.
Like this game, over mine, you could sit down and play this game.
Yes.
At like golf. Like it was one of the first games I played too. I sat down with it, and it's once you understand what you're looking at and you understand this, the degree system.
Yeah.
You can play it. I mean, you may not be very good at it, but it's a real golf game. And I'm thinking to myself, if they had this in the mid 70s, why did golf games stink until like
until the mid 90s?
Until leaderboard golf came out, because this is a perfectly playable game. Like you could sit down and get your golf jollies by playing this. I mean, it's not like playing a Wii golf game. You're not swinging, but I mean, you're actually you could get better, like you said.
Yeah.
They make this look nice. Like when you start the game, that shows the front gates of the club.
Yes.
There's graphics that they like you said. They just zooms in on the green. The courses are probably based. I wouldn't be surprised if they weren't based on a real course somewhere. I think they were.
Awesome.
I think the name of the course even written somewhere on here. I remember like Augustus or something was written on one of these. So I'm assuming these may be modeled after real courses.
It was like the site. It was like the SciTech Golf Academy or something. But I think that was just someone's.
But whatever it is, they're not kooky, and you can get better. I didn't get as good as you. I would have begged for double bogey, you know. But I did have a good time playing it. And I could absolutely see how you could get in some leaderboard challenges. And the best part of this is, much like a lot of the games on the Play-Doh, you're on an ever-present network series of terminals that go to a big computer, so all your stuff's saved.
Yeah.
When you get when you shoot 10 under par on the back nine, everyone knows it. It's on the leaderboards are up there. So and your name's in there. You know, it's the same thing with baseball or anything else. Like, they know who's done what. And so there's some bragging rights on the line.
Absolutely.
And this is, you got to think about this, Brent, because I came up in the BBS era. But, I mean, and we would have killed to have this on a BBS, by the way, this sort of game.
This is probably one step above BBS.
Yeah, it is. And my point is, like, we had live leaderboards at the time, right? But, like, the games were, like, door games, like, for example. Like, this game, to have, like, live leaderboards or the ability to chat or message about how well you've done something. I mean, it's quite remarkable.
Yeah.
For the mid-70s. Like, I never knew that world existed. And it really didn't outside of academia.
Yeah.
And corporate America. It's not like you could, no one in the 70s is going back to their pad and playing this. If you think about what you're doing, think of the amount of time and the amount of energy it took just to run those machines. So you're literally wasting time and money. That's exactly what you're doing. Yeah. If you play golf. Yeah.
If you play a round of golf, you are tying that up so someone else can't run a program or something.
So it's a mixed bag. But in terms of playability, I thought this was just perfectly fine. I mean, it's like, am I going to sit around every day and play this like I do, say, Neo Turf Masters? No.
No.
I could absolutely occasionally sit down. Like, I would love to just sit down and play a round of this with someone just for fun.
Yeah.
See how you did. It would be kind of fun.
Yeah.
But yeah, I thought this was a good choice. I enjoyed this one.
Yeah,
Brent.
I did too. To think that they were the first or among the first, since this was released in the 70s, and it's very open-ended on when this actually was available for other people to experience, which puts them among the first, not necessarily the first. They made it up all themselves. They ushered in how golf games would really work and look for many, many, many decades.
It's kind of neat to think about that.
Yeah.
You know, believe it or not, our own John Bodekar-Shaller gave your game a shot.
Yeah.
And I think this is a good summarization of your normal person's experience. Because I doubt Boat looked at the docs. And Boat got on his Atari computer and played this. He said, I gave this the good old college try. After a wonderfully drawn intro and a couple of swings driving range, I took to the first hole. After several, 20 shots to get out of the trees, I finally reached the green. Except it wasn't the green, it was the water. I couldn't find the green. I turned it off. That's that's Boat's expert summarization right there on your golf game. So there you go.
Obviously, I had a different experience, but that's okay.
Boat's not really into reading documentation either, so that wouldn't surprise me. A good game, though, Brent, on that one. Now, of course, this is one time where we're not, you can't go buy this. You can't go. No one reviewed this. Although it's gotten a very positive
modern
looks.
Yeah, you know. Modern looks.
So good choice, the brand. I like that one. But jump in the driver's seat here. So I tried a game. We tried a game a couple years ago. I mentioned it was called Telling Guard. I believe we played the C64 version, as I recall them, but don't hold me to that. They're all about the same. And so I remembered them talking about another game. And so when we got on the system, when I was looking around at the different games that were available, there was one that was called D&D. And I thought, well, I got to try one of these D&D games. And thankfully, the D&D game in front of it, it had this like literal like 7 or 8 chapter story about the history of these sort of games on the Play-Doh, right? And so one of the ones that mentioned was one that we also read about. It's what jarred my memory when we played Telling Guard. And the game they mentioned was a game called Pettit 5, P-E-D-I-T-5. Pettit 5 is regarded as the longest, it's the first graphical Dungeons & Dragons game ever made with a but. And the but is the original, there was a game before Pettit 5 that was what really is actually probably the first graphical game. But so few people saw it, and hardly anyone played it, and then it got erased almost instantly.
No.
Well, and here's why. Guess what? It was called the other game was called M199H. That rolls off the tongue, much like Pettit 5. And so it got deleted in 1974, right after it came out, because as we mentioned, they weren't too keen on people writing games for their multi-zillion-dollar educational tool.
Yeah.
All right. Now, eventually, they said to heck with it. This guy, and the fellow's name is Rusty Rutherford. He's a fellow
there that
put Pettit 5 together. And he was a big fan of, guess what, Dungeons & Dragons. That's why all these guys were playing D&D. D&D was hitting hot, especially on college scenes back in the 70s.
Yes.
And he thought to himself, "Man, I'm going to make this on the Play-Doh system." And so he developed the game over 4 to 6 weeks in late 1975. So 1974, 1975. And again, even his, I've heard both figures, and even he is not sure what it was. And so he ended up getting this thing made, and it was called Pettit 5. So why do you probably ask yourself, why was it called that dumb name? Well, it was stored in the fifth Pettit slot on his school group computer. So the, and Pettit 4, by the way, is the docs to this. If you so, this could have been Pettit 4, to be honest with you. But so here's how that works. This guy was a member of the energy group, the population energy group at the University of Illinois. And they had each person that's a, like going to school gets a certain number of slots on the mainframe. Okay. So that's why he had Pettit 1, 2, 3, and 4. And he'd already filled those up. And that's how this became Pettit 5. Just to summarize why this is called something goofy. So, as I mentioned, this is considered basically the first graphical Dungeons & Dragons game that still exists. And I was real surprised when I loaded this up, because what you get here is an actual D&D style game where you've got a character and you name him, and you are unleashed in the halls of this one level dungeon. Okay, the goal of this game is to get as much money as you can and get out of there. All right, when you load this game up, it gives you, and it's funny, all these games have an online documentation system, as you would expect.
Yeah.
And what's funny about it is it got me to thinking, this is probably why when we played stuff like the TRS-80 models 1 and 3 and some of these real old system, the System 80 and these other, they're so, that's the way that everyone did it back then. I'm guessing to myself, man, these guys probably just took the flow, because eventually you had paper documentation, and it really, even when you have your own system and you're buying a floppy disk to put in your own computer, you don't necessarily have to have online documentation, because you've got the ability to print out a manual or whatever you wanted to. I'm guessing this is something that just came along from the days of the Plato, where they just had no, so just a guess. I was thinking out loud there. So the dungeon has a fixed layout that you're in, but the monsters and the treasure are just randomly put in places. Now, this is a problem, because you may be rolling along and see a first level rat. That's great. Go kill him. Get the money. Rat can be carrying big money, too, as you found out.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you can be wandering along, walk into your first room, and then there's a dragon, and you're dead. So that this game had no level control at all. The game, of course, is made up of, like I said, the character actually looks like a little man, and the rest of it's just straight lines. Now, the dungeon has the three or four elements: walls, doors, secret doors, and then doors that make up a room, effectively, a large room.
Yeah.
When you get to a door, this control is by using the W, A, D, and X keys on your keyboard, like north, south, east, west.
And, although I got it to work with the arrow keys.
Yeah, and then you also can, when you go to a door, you have to hit B.
Yeah.
B bashes in the door.
Yeah.
And so, and then the thing is, you don't always succeed at bashing in the door. Sometimes you have to do it over and over and over and over and over before you get in.
But there's a reason for that. Because every bash takes time, and every four segments of time, a wandering monster could appear. So if you get stuck in a door trying to get through a door,
I don't think there were any wandering monsters in Pettit. Yes, I think there were in D&D.
No.
I don't think I ever saw a single one.
Yeah, because I was sitting there trying to stand up. Remember when I got stuck?
Yeah, but that was D&D. That wasn't Pettit. And the thing is, we'll get to why this is easily confused.
Okay, fair
enough.
Because
that's
I played them back to back, so yeah. I could be confusing the two.
The limitations of the system that Rutherford had to work with limited him. And the dungeon had 40 to 50 rooms on a single level. And the game could only store 20 players at a time. All right. And the problem is, this game became mega popular, like right when it came out. By the way, they tried to delete this one too. And they tried, but by then the cat was out of the bag. And people had copies all over the place. And so that's why this one's still around.
It's arrived, yeah.
This game got went all over the place because D&D was a huge deal. And, of course, eventually there were sequels made to this game. Now, let's just get – I'm going to summarize this game very quickly. You've heard me mention what you do. You'll fight rats and skeletons. You have your character is an odd, like a sort of an amalgamation of multiple D&D characters. He's a sword yielding, spell slinging guy who can also cast healing stuff. Or,
yeah.
So when you so you get spells, a limited amount of spells, and you when you you can pick up various treasures. And if you what you can do is this is what I did because I got killed over and over when I was generating a video for this review. I literally died a dozen times in like 10 minutes. You can die in 30 seconds easily. Less than
absolutely.
And then if you and you can be going for 10 minutes and die, and it's got nothing to do with you. This is a game that's it's just it's random. You might as well take dice and throw them.
You you don't really play this game, you experience
right.
it.
Right. So again, this game is hugely popular, so of course there are gonna be people that are going to try to make a better version. Eventually, a game that became even more well-known was just simply called D&D, as I mentioned it earlier, because they went back and talked about Pettit 5. And me and Brent played both. Now, D&D refined this a bit from what they had in Pettit 5. D&D had wandering monsters. D&D had potions. D&D had like slightly larger graphics that looked slightly more pleasant. It had some like a control over itself to where it didn't like... It was less random, I guess is the basic way to put it. But it was pretty much the same game. Now, here's the funny thing about all this. So we mentioned that the only reason I didn't heard about this was because of Helengard. So there's a controversy, I guess is the best way to put it, that when these games were popular to Plato, ultimately someone tried to transfer them to modern 8-bit PCs.
Yeah.
And one of the original efforts was a very popular, very well-selling game called Helengard, which we covered. And it's been pretty much established that Helengard is a complete and utter ripoff of D&D and Pettit without giving them any sort of credit or knowledge.
Well,
and if you play Helengard, if you look through the like, because these guys apparently look through the code and stuff. There's gimmicks that they were pointing out like exact points in the program and yeah. completely ripped off their gimmick.
See, that's one thing. It's one thing if you reprogram it and call it your own thing. If you do the work, if you put in the legwork, I mean that's modern. That's gaming, baby. That happens all the time. But if you're actually horking their code, that you can't do that.
Here's the thing.
You can't
do that. So here's my play on this. Okay. Number one, you ain't gonna make no money on Play-Doh game. Okay, so someone had to take the time and effort to gamble to port this over. Of course, it was an easy gamble because it was super popular. And your average schmuck would have never played D&D or Pettit 5. And secondly, it was a knockoff on D&D because I heard that the guys were like, yeah, no one ever, like the Pettit guy and the D&D guy, they never got any money, any residuals, any even mentions. So I was like, well, I mean, did you pay off Gary Gygax for, you know, did you... You obviously said this game was directly based on Dungeons & Dragons. So you get into a he said, she said thing where, like, if you go down the chart, the Helengard guy should have gave some money to Dungeons & Dragons, Pettit 5, D&D, or he could just gave no one anything, kept it all. So it's a...
No, that's... But that's not how it works.
Well, I'm just saying. I mean, everyone's stealing from everybody else is my point. So it's hard to, you know, when thieves are going like this, it is what it is. With all that said... we played Helengard all these years ago, so you have some reference point. What did you think of Pettit? And then to a second degree, what did you think of D&D?
Well, let's talk about Pettit first.
Yeah.
It's not that fun.
You hated Pettit, didn't you?
I didn't hate it. I appreciated what it was trying to do. But there is no control, right? You get one spell. Now, you can choose to have that spell be 8 different things.
Yeah.
But you get one casting of the spell.
Well, you could get more.
You can, but that's what you start with.
Yeah.
And if you run into a monster, your options are fight, run, or cast magic. If you fight,
and you can't run you can't run hardly at all.
Well, I'm going to get to that. If you fight, it's basically it rolls things behind the scene, and one of you win or loses. It doesn't let you fight and then decide to cast and run. Yeah. It is you fight until one of you are dead. So you can kind of say, well, if I run into a monster that's level one or two, I can probably win that fight, so I'll fight them. A little bit of decision there that actually matters. If you run into a monster that's like, you know, of the level three variety, starting to get up there in strength, you can go, maybe I can cast my one spell and get some pretty good golden experience. Or if I run into a monster that's higher level, maybe I can run. No, none of those choices mean anything. Because at the end of the day, you can never run. At the end of the day, I mean, you can try, but I never successfully ran.
There's a message that pops up. It says, like, there's no running.
Yeah.
It's just something like that. I read that somewhere that you can't. You can in D&D, but it's a whole different story.
For casting, it might save you that one time that you can cast, but I never had it do anything.
I read that there's a method to the casting. You can cast certain spells on certain things that are not undead below level four. But I mean, we didn't get into it a long time before we could figure this out.
Right. That's the flow chart stuff. But so ultimately, it is you wandering around the dungeon, praying nothing actually shows up.
Yeah.
And then when it does show up, if it's level one or two, you might win. If it's anything higher than that, you're just dead. So it's not a whole lot of fun. It was kind of neat that you could find hidden doors. I thought that was kind of cute.
Yeah.
It's kind of neat that everything is so random that even the loot is random. I found like 40 gold on a rat, which was more than any other creature had ever held in the entire game.
I like the fact that you were carrying around 250 silver.
Yeah.
That would be a pain in the butt.
So, I mean, it's a product of its time.
Yeah.
And it was the first one doing its thing. So I appreciate where it got us. But it's not something you want to go back and experience today. The D&D version, the next version out, was better.
Yeah.
It had actual stats. You could sit there and re-roll until you got a character that wasn't complete garbage.
You could actually run. You could retreat from battle in the hall, which was good. You could. In the hall. Not in the room. That's why I knew that one had wandering monsters, because that's when it would work.
You had more control over the choices meant more. You had basically the same choices, but they meant more.
You had all your characteristics when you rolled up a guy.
Yeah. So it was a natural evolution of what came before it, and
it was very much like
Avant-Garde. I wouldn't seek out the Play-Doh to play this, especially when you can just play Talon Guard and get basically the same experience.
I mean, almost exactly the same experience.
But this was, it definitely was something that showed the evolution.
I was surprised at the graphics on both these games, because I wasn't expecting any. In fact, I was surprised by the graphics overall in Play-Doh.
Oh, they were excellent.
I was surprised that they had it. I mean, of course, again, we were playing games that were basically made post-1974, when you had the Play-Doh 4 out. Of course, some of the previous versions, if you saw some of these other versions of the Play-Doh, I mean, they're basically are super ancient style. You know, you weren't playing games. You weren't on jack squat.
Yeah.
I mean, the Play-Doh 4 gave you a lot more. I mean, it had a touchscreen, for God's sakes. But I was surprised with the graphic fidelity. One thing I wanted to mention, as we're summing up on the Play-Doh here. The Play-Doh had a lot of firsts. We sort of mentioned, we're probably looking at the first graphical D&D, probably the first golf. It absolutely had Space War, which we know what that spawned. That was in 69. D&D, the game we played, it has according to sources, it had the first video game boss ever to appear in a game. Of course, we mentioned Pettit. They had a game called Avatar that came out in 78. 60-player, 2.5D graphical multi-user dungeon.
Yeah.
So this was the birth of MUDs.
Yeah.
If you were into MUDs,
like, and I heard it was huge,
like,
too.
The Chud was a big MUD guy back in the day. They had a game called Empire, which is a 30-person multiplayer 2D real-time space simulator in 74.
Yeah. And I saw footage of that. I mean, it was all wireframe.
Yeah.
Right? And it was kind of chunky,
yeah.
But it was still really nice. It was really impressive.
They had a game called Spasm, which was a 32-player, first-person 3D space battle game. Again, that was in 74. Think about this. You have, and I played a game, which is actually on this list, called Air Flight. This was a flight simulator that was used. They actually were planning on using this to learn how to actually pilot a plane.
Yep.
Which is kind of key. And they say this was probably what inspired the birth of Microsoft Flight Simulator, which is neat. There was also something on here that inspired the birth of Battlezone, that game, if you ever played that. There's a lot of stuff on here that people played back when they were younger that got them into do it later. Free Cells, another thing that showed up on here. So there was a lot of gaming. It's amazing to me that something like the Play-Doh could spawn so many gaming firsts, and also could be the thing that provided the seed that was planted to provide us with all these other games.
Well, when you are the first, it's easy to be the first of a lot of things.
It's still, don't undersell it.
Why? It was amazing.
The Play-Doh was really neat. We had a lot of fun this week on the Play-Doh, Brent. And like I said, don't take our word for it. Hop out there and watch a little documentary stuff on this, or even get yourself an account. It's free. It's not that difficult to use once you fiddle with it.
Yeah.
One last thing I do, again, want to thank Pajaco for holding my hand and letting me use his account to get in there. And also, he put up a thing with all the shortcuts for all the keys that they've swapped over. But once you get used to using the keys, it's like second nature. It took me back to when I was using the computers at the library back when I was a kid, when they first got them. Well, I mean, today we've got error keys, left, right, enter, whatever. In the old days, you had weird keys. You know, the data key, the aha key, stuff like that. That should be brought back, by the way, aha key. Speaking of aha, let's spin the wheel.
Aaron, what did you add this week on the old Wheel-a-Rooney?
Well, it's our Retro Rewind piece this week. We've got the Intellivision. I've been dying to get some Intellivision in. And we've also added, Lob's Terminator suggested, the Exidy Sorcerer. I love the name of that. Fire that sucker up. Put your laptop down so you can see what you're doing, or hold that thing up higher. There you go.
You have a wish?
I don't care. Listen, that's your Play-Doh. I'm happy. I'm right on cloud nine. That's a heck of a spin. 3D half the wheel, eh? He's zooming it in. All right, Exidy Sorcerer.
Wow, just added. Get it on, get Exidy it off. Exidy
Sorcerer that's been suggested by Lob's Terminator. I don't think we've ever tried. We ever tried the Exidy before? That's hard to believe. We never got around to that one. So that'll be a lot of fun. We're going to be playing games on the Exidy Sorcerer. I think Mr. actually supports this, if I'm not mistaken. So that'll make it easier for me. Now, let's talk about next week, Brent. When we're hopping into a little thing I like to call the Atari ST show. We're back. We're back in the New York groove, Brent. And we're, as suggested by our game selection committee. By the way, I want to give a special shout out to Mitsuyama.
Absolutely.
Who has whipped the game selection committee back into shape. And now we're getting games nice and steady stream. Next week, we're going to be playing Bonanza Brothers,
Brent,
on the Atari ST show. That should be a lot of fun. I should ask you, as we roll this one up, the Brent, what did you think of your time filling in on Amigos this week? You picked a real winner this week in Risky Woods. Did you enjoy Risky Woods?
It wasn't the worst thing
ever. What did you enjoy more, Risky Woods or golf?
I mean, golf was far less frustrating.
I knew you were going to say that. Hey, just a couple announcements I want to make before we close shop. We're doing it. We're bringing it back. This is the last one for sure this time. I'm not lying, brother. We're bringing back the International Computer Club, everybody. We're going to go on April 20th at 4 p.m. International Computer Club is a bunch of our good buddies all get together and have our own computer club that's worldwide, representing every time zone, every country on Earth. Everybody is going to be there. So the UN of computer clubs. And what happens at these clubs meetings is that people just give demonstrations. Book reviews. They talk about the newest updates they've done to their system. They demonstrate hardware. Sometimes we get product reviews. Sometimes we get video game boxes they give us their whole collection, game room tours. We've seen it all on there, Brent. And so this should be no exception. Today, the sign-up sheet should be going up for the International Computer Club meeting, again, April 20th at 4 p.m. to accommodate our European viewers and listeners. And hey, if you're part of our Discord, sign up and show up. And if you're just someone who's just an interested third party, we'll be broadcasting on Twitch and on YouTube on that day. So you can just catch the show live in living color. So that should be a lot of fun. We should also mention, Brent, listen, we haven't really built that much, but we're going to talk about it because it's coming up. in June. And if you go over to Boatfest, dot, I think it's boatfest.info, you're going to get the Boatfest 2024 page where you can buy your tickets. This thing is going down Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, June 14th, 15th, and 16th, live here in Herkimer, West Virginia, down at our event center downtown. We're going to have a good crowd of friends coming down. I've already talked to a lot of people. We're getting a lot of real interesting displays and computers that are coming down. I mean, and the funny thing is we're going to get stuff that was sort of around at the same time as the Play-Doh on the home front. We're going to have Ataris, BBC Micros, ZX Spectrums, Amigas, Cocos, Atari STs, everything. All the colors in the computer rainbow are going to be there. Video gaming. There'll be live shows. We'll do some live shows there. There'll be an auction. The auction was a huge success last year. There'll be good eating, picnic, the whole nine yards. Get your tickets now at boatfest.info. We hope to see you there. Brent, I'm excited about this one. I just bought a new game this week, by the way. Did you see what I bought? I got a Commodore 64 board game, and we're going to play that at the feature table. That should be a lot of fun. So join us for that. Anything you'd like to plug here before? There's one more thing. In a few hours, we'll be going live to for part two of Boat's Dungeons & Dragons game.
I believe in just less than 2 hours, an hour and a half.
Yeah, we'll be at Boat's heading out. We'll be going to play some D&D, live D&D on the stream. It'll be on Twitch. It'll be on YouTube, I think. And it'll be a lot of fun. We'll see if Boat can finish us off like you did. In the most painful way. Yeah, because you're mean guy. Anything you'd like to say or plug before we take it to the house?
Nope.
All right. Thanks for joining us this week for Play-Doh. We'll be back next week for Bonanza Bros on the ST Show. And then in a couple weeks, we'll be tackling the Exidy Sorcerer. That's all we got. Taste of the house, Brent. See you later, everybody.